Welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host World Poetry Open Mic, The Michael Amade Show, author of more books than I should mention, musician, poet, and above all, creative entrepreneur. My collaborator and conspirator in this project is Clifford Brooks, founder of the Southern Collective Experience, host of Dante's Old South on NPR, poet and author of The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, Exiles of Eden, and Athena Departs, The Gospel of a Man Apart. Our guest today is Sean Crawford. He is the force behind the publishing company, The Calliope Group, and he edits the site Calliope Crashes. He has some great things to teach us about the publishing game and the business of being a creative person. Without further ado, here is our interview with Sean Crawford.
Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, where to begin? I grew up in Kansas in a little town called El Dorado, and I was a library kid. That was the one spot where my parents would always take us to discover and learn and just grew up with the love of books, which led me to becoming an English major, which of course means that once I finished my studies, I had to find a job in some other sector and started working in the nonprofit space. Actually found that I really enjoyed it, and over the years really had the opportunity to work with some great groups and some great projects, but always in the back of my mind, I wanted to be more engaged with literature and books and things of that nature. And so a few years ago, I started a website called Calliope Crashes, which is an online place to kind of discover pop culture and poetry and some other things that are going on in a unique way. We don't want to be clickbait. We don't want to make listicles. We just really want to have a spot to enjoy some good writing and a take on what's going on, maybe in a unique way. And as that grew and was able to speak with some writers and other people, I always wanted to be able to publish, but there was never really a way to accomplish that that was economical. The upfront costs, the overhead were just so daunting that just really didn't feel like it was feasible. But in the last few years, with the change in printing technology and digital, and really being able to print sort of as a hybrid of on demand, yet with the quality you want, there was an opportunity there to perhaps finally have that come to fruition. And so we started a little indie publishing house called the Calliope Group, and got one title out, have another coming out this fall.
Now, why Calliope? How does that resound with you to then translate onto the page and into a company?
When we were looking for a name, we started thinking and looking, and I thought about perhaps muses, and it turns out that the muse of eloquence and poetry is Calliope. And at the same time, we wanted to engage pop culture. And a calliope is also a steam organ that they used to especially put on the back of a trailer when the circus would come to town. They'd pull the calliope through the street with the rest of the parade. Unbelievably loud music plays out of a calliope. And then, of course, you have to have a little Springsteen reference there. So Blinded by the Light has the line, "The calliope crashed to the ground." We put all those together and came up with Calliope Crashes.
Titles intrigue me. Did you sit there and really think about it, or did the Calliope Crashes, did that kind of come to you in your subconscious?
The Calliope came pretty quickly, but then it was like, well, what else do we do with that? How else can we use that to kind of convey who we want to be? And especially online, we want to be the mashup of talking about pop culture in a unique way, maybe a little more eloquently with the actual circus that's going on every day all around us.
That's what I, you snatched the words out of my mouth, because when I was first introduced months ago to your website, when I heard pop culture, I wouldn't say that it took a cloud in with me, but like I just didn't know what to expect, because like you just pointed out, many people use that as a tool to, you know, spout their rage or to stay on one track. And Calliope Crashes, the website, is exactly what you're talking about. When you see the tab rant, you know, you click on that waiting, oh God, here we go. But it's not yelling. It is a, this is my opinion, this is where I'm coming from. And it's done with a creativity that, at least the way I read it, it lifts me out of my own trepidation and fears, really, to a very comfortable place. Is that kind of what your the goal was or is?
Yeah, it always was. And the sort of the signature column on the site is called The Rant. It started out as the Wednesday Pop Culture Rant, so it ran every Wednesday. It's kind of gotten shortened over the years. That was actually, the rant started as a way to relieve boredom at work. I would write these little group emails at work with links to celebrity gossip and movies, and then I'd just make this little comment on each one, and it got really popular. Matter of fact, I was spending more time writing that at work than working. So that sort of grew then into the Wednesday Pop Culture Rant, and finally Calliope Crashes. But yeah, we're trying to be a little lighter, just trying to have a little bit of fun, and just trying to create a voice of, you know, what's going on, what can we, what are some ways maybe we can put unusual ideas together and then have a good time with it, you know, especially now it's like, everybody's looking for a way out of that normal conversation, like you said, the anger or the frustration that always seems to be spilling over.
And that's, it's rare to find that. And it always, and again, I may be reaching here, but there's an extremely intelligent satirical edge to it. Is that intentional?
Yes, that's always been, I'm Irish. I've always loved Irish literature. And my hero really is Flann O'Brien. Flann O'Brien was an Irish writer, not as many people know. He stayed in Ireland. He stayed in Dublin when Joyce and Beckett and everyone else was leaving. And he wrote fantastic newspaper column. He was an Irish civil servant. He worked for the government, but he had a pen name, and he'd write these just hilarious satires of the Irish language and Dublin and the government and the sort of romanticizing of the rural life when, in fact, everybody was barely surviving. And he's always sort of been my light in how I want to address those things.
Now, has the Calliope Group, when, as far as the books that they want to work on, that they gravitate towards, what does the Calliope Group look for in authors and poets?
The Calliope Group right now is looking for unique voices. It's also looking for voices that perhaps have difficulty finding a home. So that's going to be people on the margins. It's going to be, as we move forward, we're going to look to create anthologies with collections of voices that people can, we hope, connect to. And maybe places where you hear the idea, you realize it's fantastic, but for whatever reason, lots of other places have passed on those. And so we want to step in there and be able to give those places a home. And just, you know, we're not interested in bringing out 10 titles a year. We want to be selective. We want to really be able to find stories we want to tell, unique ideas, and then really sort of move on from there.
Well, what books do you have out now or have on the pipeline for us?
Well, right now, our first book that's out right now is The Skin of Dreams, and it's a new and collected works by a poet named Koresh Alilansana. Koresh is a really unique poet in that he grew up in Enid, Oklahoma. Then he moved to Chicago, and he was the last person to be mentored by Gwendolyn Brooks, the fantastic Chicago poet, worked with her, brought out some of her collected works after she had passed away, and is just a powerful poet. But one of the reasons I really appreciate his work is he's lived both this rural and urban life as an African American, which I think is a very unique voice. And he tells fantastic stories in his poems. He's a historian. He has a collection of poems in Harriet Tubman's voice, and there's a selection of them in the book that are just, they're amazing. They're just an incredible window into that world, into the Underground Railroad, and into stories that people haven't heard.
And when I read, when you emailed me the book, and I checked out, that's the Harriet Tubman ones were the ones that I was going to aim for. But what I'll tell you, that what I picked up first, and I didn't catch it in there that he was a historian, but that's what he's a storyteller in his poems. More than trying to get his own point across, it feels to me at least that his poetry is holding your hand and taking you down a road that's strangely familiar, but also at the same time new around every corner. Have you heard that before? Am I getting in the right ballpark?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to describe the work. He's just, you know, and it's the old adage of show, don't tell. He's going to show you this slice of the world, whether it's his own experience or historical. And that's what, again, I think makes, we all just call him Q. I think that's what makes Q unique. And just a powerful voice when he's telling a story. And really, at all different levels, there's family stories, there's tragic stories, there's a little bit of poetry that almost serves as journalism and humor and everything else. He's got a great poem in there about going to the one sort of nightclub in Enid, Oklahoma, when he was growing up. Some people help him sneak in. He's in eighth grade, and of course, the club gets raided that night. And just a great poem about growing up and, you know, transgression, and you always end up getting caught, and just those kind of stories you can really relate to.
It all clicks now, because in poetry, there again, when you show and don't tell, I've often said that it's not critical that someone, that the reader takes away exactly what you meant as the poet. But I also want to get it in the same area of, like, am I on the right track? And I'm glad that I am. And I mean, this is what I urge people to, and what drew me so much to want to have you on the show, is that all the book in and of itself epitomizes everything you've said. You know, it's, you know, voices, and I can see how these excellent poems would not fit this grand kind of homogenized view of what poetry should be. And I think it's because it's so, his Q's poetry is so absolutely accessible. And this is my opinion, that that's the kind of writing that changes people's minds, because these poems are not barbed and they're not pointed at people. They're slyly educating you with the truth. And the truth being the way he grew up. And then when he kind of establishes his own poetic voice and who he is, where, you know, again, in I don't know if this is the way the book was designed, but when you move towards those Harriet Tubman poems, you kind of, you know who he is, so that when you read these poems, you know where his love lies and why he did it. And I admire that so much, because I'm never on the edge of my seat of, like, oh God, here's where I get yelled at, or here's where I feel bad. He skirts around all of that so gracefully and creates a tapestry, you know, to say that the new and collected poems, I felt like I should have known this guy before. It's a phenomenal book.
Yeah, and that's our, certainly our feeling as well. I think in some ways, Hugh had a reputation in Chicago. He's decided to move back to Oklahoma, and we've just got to get his voice and his story out there. And, you know, he needs to be on a bigger stage. He needs to be on a national stage. And but he's had a remarkable career. This is his first collected poems. He spent a lot of time thinking about when he wanted to do it, and he felt like this was the time. And it's interesting you say that about that journey through the different collections, because He actually gave all of his work to a couple of people to put the collection together, which I thought was both interesting and brave.
Agreed.
To allow someone else to let their eye sort of think about, hey, what are the correct poems from each work and how do they work together? And I'm glad to hear you say that it feels like, you know, it flows then into those Tubman poems from his experience and then, you know, back through. Even though the book is set up chronologically, there was a lot of thought given to the poems from each collection working together.
It's so, I don't feel so alone now that you've said that, because I've asked people to do that, because I'm, as a poet, I'm obviously close to my work, but when it comes to the way they read best in a sequence, I find that I'm too close to it to make that decision. And I'm curious to ask him that, if that's what kind of why he did it. Because if somebody said, well, pick out your favorites, I'm like, I always feel like I'm egotistical to go back and pick from my favorites. You know, I just don't know if maybe that's why he did it. But there has to be a tremendous amount of humility in that as well, to hand it over and trust people to do that. Did you play a hand in any of that decision making?
No, I did not. Actually, what had happened was, Q had gotten back the rights to his previous work, his previous 8 books, and was looking, you know, do the collected poems. And completely fortuitous, we met each other in Tulsa. I was talking about my plans about trying to launch a press. He was trying to figure out what he wanted to do now that he sort of controlled his own work. And I will say, to his credit, for such an established poet, he was willing to take a chance with us and let us put that book together. And we're just so excited to be able to have him as our first author. And then he's going to help us moving forward to sort of be our poetry editor, really, because I trust him. I trust his eye. And so he's going to kind of take on that role of editor. He's great at mentoring poets and getting collections into shape. So he'll kind of be handling that side of things for now.
In your experience, Sean, when you met with Q and all that kind of clicked and how fortuitous that meeting felt, do you feel like when you're doing the right work with the right people for the right reasons, these moments manifest themselves?
I think so. I think you figure out who's a good fit for you. And again, we're just a little press. We're not feeling the pressure of, hey, we got to have 5 titles out in the fall. We're only going to print what we love and that we believe in, which is, of course, what everyone says right before they declare bankruptcy. But the idea of the dream is still there. So we're going to take our time. We're going to do it. And the nice thing for the authors is, because we don't have a huge number of releases, that gives us the ability to promote through a longer cycle for the author, because then we can sort of take our time with it and do that. And when you don't have enormous budgets for marketing, you got to kind of take the long cycle a little bit more.
I almost tore out of my seat right now. The marketing aspect of it, which sounds so ridiculous for me to say as an adult, but like, the marketing of it is so important. Of course it is. You know, like, advertising, you know, is not an evil construct. It's how you get people to know about what it is you have, but they're not going to buy anything if they don't know you have it to sell. What ways is the Calliope Group moving towards the advertising angle, the long game of that? What do you have on your plate?
Yeah, that's something we're figuring out as we go. Obviously, social media is a huge part of that. It gives you access to an audience at a low per eyeball cost. So
exactly.
Obviously, we're using our social media platforms. And that includes both normal and advertising, you know, through those channels. We have our website. We have distribution through Ingram, which quite honestly is now the only distributor in town.
Right.
That I believe Baker's actually going away. So I think that's crucial for a small press. Yes, the discount is painful that you have to give to work through that channel. But by the same token, then I have access to every bookstore and every online platform without trying to manage all that. So that's very important. Then we're trying to find key portals, you know, places like LitHub, places like New Pages, you know, doing selected advertising, and then getting the results back and slowly but surely kind of figure out what's working.
It's the publishing is one of the sayings I like to probably say too often is it's like nailing Jell-O to the wall. You know, it's a construct that I don't think you ever have exactly figured out, but hearing you talk about it imbues hope because you have a construct, you have an idea of where the moving pieces are, and the fact that you speak to say, we're going to see what works and move these pieces around. I so often hear, we've got the way it works this way, and it's going to work this way every time. I'm not trying to be a cynic, but I'm put off by that because I don't think anybody's got it exactly figured out. And to hear somebody say, we're going to take this at our speed with the long game and find out what works and what doesn't work, but the overhead is always on our mind. Is that kind of what you were saying?
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. Yeah, and it's not one size fits all.
Exactly.
And when you're really going to publish what you love, the diversity of audiences is just going to be so large that you're going to have to tailor what you do to different things. But we've all seen, you know, whether it's a Facebook ad or a newsletter email you get that, you know, these three steps will guarantee X number of sales for your book, or, you know, learn the one true secret that, you know, if that were the case, then everybody would, you know, sell 500,000 copies of their book.
Right. Or, you know, by the time that they release those three things, 40,000 other people have already done it before you got there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the absolute lack of snake oil salesman in you makes me want to cheer your name every day. That's what we want to promote. You know, that's what we want to have on the show. That's what we want to get out there because in the literary circles, people so bemoan, you know, well, oh God, success and the art world is just a small pond with tons of big fish. And this is another one of the adages I probably say too often, but I think that the art world is an expansive open ocean with too many fish that don't want to share. And when you find folks like you who have this realistic expectation and knowledge of the business market, but when you said, you know, there's just so many people that like so many things, we want to hold on to like one angle at it. And that angle with the Calliope Group, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be integrity and honesty. Is that close to the point?
Well, that's certainly what we're trying to do. And as somebody who also writes, I know the way I would like to be treated and the relationship that I would like to have with whoever's helping to distribute my content. And so, you know, we want to be more than fair. We want to be, you know, more than generous in how we pay royalties and how we take care of expenses and do things of that nature. But I mean, we've all heard those stories I think it's a good point when you talk about art. Look, somebody's always making money.
Right.
And tragically, most of the time, it's not the artist. And so if you could, you know, we're a tiny, tiny little space. But if there's success, our feeling is the artist has to share in that. It's their content. It's their creation. It's what they have sort of poured themselves into. And for me, a publisher's job really is just to make that available to people. You know, it's not my content. It's not what I labored over and, you know, and you know this as a writer too, you know, gave up part of yourself to accomplish. And so, you know, you deserve every single part of that success. When I was a very young freelancer, I was in a library and I saw a magazine that had one of my stories on the cover. I didn't know the magazine. I had never been paid for it. I had no awareness that it had even been published. So I call the original periodical and they give me this long story about sometimes they loan their work out to other places things of that nature. And that was just such a bitter experience for me. And I thought, if I'm ever in a position, you know, to make sure that doesn't happen to other people, I'm going to do that. And, you know, it wasn't long after that I got a notice of a class action suit. They'd been doing that to everybody. They'd been reselling people's work in other markets without telling them.
And it is eerie how on point this conversation, man. I've spoken with more than a few authors, and it's always in whispered tones of a shame, like a shame that they feel that, you know, we're not getting numbers from our publisher, and you know, they gave me an advance, but then, you know, when I try to ask for my sales numbers now, it seems to be this huge hassle. And I remember this one guy's wife said, well, you know, maybe the publishers, they just don't have good accountants. And I said, no, they have excellent accountants to stay open. And I don't feel like this is conjecture, and I say this with zero emotion. Practically, they have to have great, you know, because Al Capone was caught by the IRS, not the Popo. So get your numbers straight, you know. And I got angry for them because the guy, he's like, you know, long story short, he said, you know, that when I said, well, no, I feel like they probably have great accountants on their side, because if they didn't, you know, they'd get in trouble. And it shouldn't be difficult for you to get these numbers. And he said, well, you know, maybe I'm just lucky to have a book out. And I don't know if that's kind of the same thing that you've dealt with and you've seen, but I feel like with your short story, well, you should just be happy that he got out there. And that's not the way it is. You know, it's that hard work and a piece of yourself to be indignant at that kind of egotism to take your work and not even tell you about it. You know, it deserves a class action lawsuit. I mean, so let me ask you this. I mean, now that we're on the point of the one of the aspects that you do with the Calliope Group as far as publishing, what other aspects make your publishing house unique?
One is we pay, I'm not going to tell you what it is or I'll be flooded with manuscripts, but we pay one of the highest royalty rates in publishing, and we pay it out of the gate. That's another story you hear a lot of times. You know, you'll get your royalty net of expenses.
Yep.
Well, yep. What exactly does that entail in the end? You know, what expenses should really count against your book and which are just the normal operating of the publisher? On and on and on it goes. So my thought from the very beginning was, hey, you sell that first book, you're getting a royalty on it. And those are, you know, those are the costs the publisher has decided to incur to be in the business. And so, you know, those royalties belong to. We also pay net retail royalties. So whatever we sell the book for, you get that percentage. So there's no weird formula involving wholesale and printing costs or whatever the case. Whatever Calliope sells the book for to whatever outlet, that's how the royalty is determined, which sounds, all that's a little wonky, but it's to say every book that sells, you get a piece of.
Doesn't sound wonky at all. It sounds absolutely the best thing I've heard all day, to be absolutely honest with you. Now, we've talked about Q's book. Now, you said you had another one coming out in the fall. What's that one about?
That one is a book by Terrence Hawkins. I know you know Terry. I think he's one of the editors over at Blue Mountain Review.
He is.
Yeah. And we're bringing out a revised version of a book he wrote a few years ago, and another story, lost his publisher, book's out of print. Book is more timely than ever. It's called American Neolithic. It's a great story.
I love that book.
As we sell it, you know, it's the day after tomorrow. America is kind of a quasi-police state. There's a murder that happens. The main suspect is a bit odd, and it turns out that the reason he's a bit odd is because he's a Neanderthal.
That is just, oh, it's such a good book. It's such, I'm not trying to be a big fanboy on the show, but I mean, it is some of the most classy satire I have read today. You know, it's contemporary satire is what I'm trying to say. Do you find it a challenge to kind of vacillate between poets and fiction or prose, or do the different genres excite you as a publisher?
Yes, we just like good writing, and when something's well written, and for that particular genre, that's what excites us. That's what we're interested in. And obviously not every genre is going, to really be in our wheelhouse, but poetry, certainly this speculative fiction that Terry's created, that works great. The interesting thing about that book, when it first came out, was much more a commentary on, the erosion of our freedom because of the fear of terror, the fear of other things. But as Terry was revising it, and you read it again, it's really a book about immigration. It's really a book about being the other, being the outsider, being feared because you're different. And it's only been 5 years, but that book reads in a completely different way now, given the political atmosphere. It's really amazing.
And I think that, and again, I may be absolutely oversimplifying this, but it seems like the overarching universal appeal of not just the topic, but the way that the book is written is the reason why we have those novels that are considered classics, the poets that are considered classics that we continue to read, because they're just as topical now. And as we grow, the meaning changes with them. There's something magical about that. And again, I kind of go back to when you met Q, there was a magic there that, I was there with this idea and he was there with his idea. And it was just the perfect time at the perfect place. I feel that's the same thing, or is it the same thing that you feel with Terry's work now with the Calliope Group?
I think that's a great insight you had. What makes a piece of literature, really any art, what we call, classic, is every time you come to it, there's something for you for that particular moment in that particular place. And I think we've all read a book that we loved. We read it 10 years later and we think, oh my gosh, that's dated. That's so, it has nothing to say anymore.
Right.
Yet the things that you love, every time you come back to them, they still speak to you. It's just in a different way according to the moment. And that's, again, those are the kind of works that are really exciting.
Now, I see, and we've talked about how the Calliope Group is unique. And let me turn the table a little bit into not the cons, but kind of the unexpected challenges. What were some of the challenges in creating your publishing house and kind of those stumbling blocks that you didn't expect?
I think the biggest challenge is just getting seen when there's so many voices out there. I'll be honest with you, there's too much content. Because everything is 24/7, because there's all of these platforms, there's so much content out there that being seen, being recognized becomes a huge challenge. And, I think you have to really work hard to be heard. And I think really the biggest challenge for us is getting people to take a chance on a small publishing house. Indie bookstores, we love them, but even an indie bookstore has to be careful with their purchases by what they're going to carry in the store. And so we have to just really be out there making a case that, hey, we're a title that's worth you investing a little bit in, even though you don't know a lot about us yet. And I want to be one of those places where if it comes out from the Calliope Group, it's going to be good. Doesn't matter what the genre is. Doesn't matter who the author is. And, growing up, the perfect example to me of that is Atlantic Records.
Yeah.
If a musician was on Atlantic Records, it was going to be good, period. Didn't matter who it was or the style of music. That's what we want to be.
What I love about what attracts me to small and middle range publishers is the ability, again, the accessibility, it plays a huge role in that. You and I could schedule a phone call and that phone call would happen. You know, you obviously do promote the hands-on, the professional yet comfortable relationship between the publisher and the author. With things like the book covers and the design, does the author get to have some say in how that works?
Yeah, the author gets to have huge input in that. In fact, the cover of The Skin of Dreams, Q found that artist and said, "What do you think about this image? The cover of the book is beautiful." That's a local Tulsa artist, and we're excited to be able to get the rights to use that. So yeah, they have a lot of say, a lot of input. Right now, we're being so picky with who we work with. I don't have concerns about those things. I know that we can do it. You know, if it's a new author or someone we've never worked with, they're still going to have input. They may not have quite as much leeway, you know, with some of those decisions, you know, as it goes through. I won't say who the author is, but an upcoming book wanted a white font for the cover that just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, it's like getting what's the joke about getting a painting that's pure white and you ask what it is and it's a white rabbit caught in a snowstorm?
Yeah.
Like, no. That's not going to work for me. Yeah. I'm going to go somewhere else in my business. And that's, I mean, again, I keep prefacing everything. It's not me jumping on a bandwagon or trying to be a fanboy, but these things light me up because you balance well, it seems to me, the professional expectations and, okay, I know this person and I know this person is not going to put something pornographic on the cover, but for those people I don't really know well, we're going to be a little more tight with what's expected so we're not in that kind of train wreck.
Yeah, I think you have to balance those things. And as you said, at the end of the day, you are a business. You know, it is art, but it's also a product. So how are you going to be able to balance, you know, those things together? And it's very interesting. You know, it's like actors who want to be singers.
Right.
You know, sometimes writers want to be graphic artists or they want to be marketing professionals or, you know, whatever the case might be. So you got to, again, you just have to find that balance. Sometimes you have to take something with a grain of salt. And but when it comes to content, they are in charge. It's their work. It's their, you know, whatever suggestions we make when it comes to the actual content is that's all it is, because that. Ultimately, that's their work. That's their name. That's what they wanted to create.
Now, I want to take the work from, or the conversation from the product to the location. And I got to ask, why stay in Oklahoma given the perception that living there is a vast cultural and intellectual desert? Why not move to a bigger city or a place more known for literature? Why stay put?
Yeah, that's something we've kicked around a lot over the years. I've always lived in the Midwest, grew up there. My wife grew up in Tulsa. We've always kind of wanted to come back here. And Tulsa has really become an interesting place to be. It's always had great music. You know, it's the home of country swing with Bob Wills. Mm. It's the home of so much country, bluegrass. A lot of people don't know. I bet you could name 10 jazz musicians and you would be shocked to learn 4 of them were from Oklahoma. Just a very fertile place for that. And Tulsa has really started to invest in the arts, invest in infrastructure to support them. Q has actually recently become what's called a Tulsa Artist Fellow. That includes an annual stipend, a place to live, a studio, and then opportunities to engage with other artists and get their work out there. And there's probably 30 or 40 of those in the city right now, a part of that program. So it's just creating this great energy, this great dynamic. I had a friend once, incredibly smart, was offered a tenure professorship in Cleveland, was thinking about going, and one of his friends said to him, you know, the little town you live in deserves great teachers, too.
Agreed.
The little town you live in deserves great art, too. The little town you live in deserves the best as well. And that always has really stuck with me, that we can create a place that has what we want, what we value, what we want to share with the world. And just like right now, as we are creating a podcast, you know, across the United States, with technology, with access now, we can accomplish those things. So, you know, we're really committed to Tulsa. We're really committed to this area, and we're excited about what's happening here.
And it's, people often think of rural areas being a wasteland, and I see it exactly as you do, as a ground fertile for ideas. And the distance from, I truly believe, and I have seen this in action, and I know in myself, that I know when I write and I remove myself from people, I'm much more productive. When I see people building their own culture away from the constant influence and inundation of pop culture from big cities, they come up with some brilliantly unique and original ideas. And it sounds like that's what you're building in Tulsa.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And, you know, you've been to those places where whatever the art is, it could just become this echo chamber where
exactly
everyone's saying the same thing. Everyone, you know, the running joke that every book that comes out of New York is about someone in an MFA program that's, you know, having a problem with their creativity. I mean, there's only so many books you can write like that.
You were so right. I never thought about that.
Let's go somewhere else. Let's go have a different experience. And yeah, I think it's important for understanding. You know, I have a friend in New York I go see a couple times a year. People in New York have no idea what our life is like. And when I come home, and no one in Tulsa knows what that life is like. And so we're just going to have to find some ways to communicate better and authentically show who we are, what we're about in all of these different places.
Now, for folks, before going any farther and I get any more excited and talk your ear off, tell us where we can find your website, the publishing house, the Calliope Group, and get a hold of the books that you're selling now and will be selling.
Yeah, very easy. TheCalliopeGroup.com. And Calliope is Calliope. But TheCalliopeGroup.com.
How do you see the Calliope Group developing over, like, let's say 5-10 years?
My sort of ideal would be 4 to 5 books a year, always in the spring, probably a poetry title, so you could tie in with National Poetry Month, and
yes,
that's when those things seem to be going on. Some sort of anthology, and we're working on an anthology right now about evangelicals, and especially millennial evangelicals that are trying to stay within the church. At the same time, they feel isolated and alone. And I think there's some great, great stories there to be told. And then some sort of fiction, novel, short story collection. And I'd eventually like to get to a creative nonfiction title. And we're just going to have to keep kind of thinking about what we'd like that to look like.
I love it. Amadeh, you got anything?
I'm just sitting back and listening to this and really appreciating getting to hear the whole whole story here. I think, you know, Cliff and I have talked quite a bit about the necessity of having ethical people in the mid-range to small press world. Because there's a lot of the opposite of that. There's some great people, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not calling down mid-range to small presses, of course. However, I think someone who prizes the art, kind of takes, in a lot of respects, the responsible stance for making sure the artist comes along with them. You're partners in this venture. You're not just deigning to put their book out and then loaning the work to someone else or something, you know, something like that. So I can definitely commend you on that. So let me ask you, I mean, so I'm always interested in artistic processes, and I think that you're kind of approaching this you're approaching publishing as an art, it sounds like to me, as a craft in itself. So in your own process, when you're sitting down to do work on this kind of thing, what is your process like? Do you do it in the morning time? Do you do it in the afternoons? How do you go about sitting down to do this work?
Right now we're a startup, so you just find those spaces where you have time. I mean, quite honestly.
Sure.
And you look for those opportunities where you can spend a little time. One thing, I like to do is really kind of think about the overall book when it comes out. You know, that's everything from the cover to the font to the layout to and this sounds odd, but I love book spines.
Me too.
What does that spine look like when it's sitting on the shelf? And
exactly.
You know, all of those different kinds of things so that, you know, my oldest son's 22 and he will not read off of an e-reader. He wants the object. He wants the book. So within our budgets and what we can do, how can we create a nice object then that also has this great piece of writing within it?
I think that's a great way to look at things. And do you sit there and do you workshop this with other people, or are you able to look back? And of course you talk with the author, but do you sit back and kind of envision this, or is this something that develops naturally through conversations, or how does that usually turn out for you?
Yeah, really our process right now is the author, myself, and I have a great book designer. And so we have a conversation. I communicate a lot of times both my ideas and the author's then to the book designer, and we kind of start from there. And I've worked with this person. His name is Michael Gutierrez. I've worked with him in other sectors for 15 years almost. And you just get that relationship where you can describe what you want the end product to be, and he can envision it, make it a reality for you. And I'll just say that, you know, if you're interested in publishing, and website design's the same way, don't scrimp on a good designer. Don't scrimp on great graphic art, because it's just another piece of the puzzle. So really it's those three things. It's the author, it's myself, it's Michael, the book designer, and we just kind of start swapping ideas. But Michael creates all the templates, all the looks, and then we distribute them back out and tweak them from there.
I think that's a great process, and I love that you're highlighting this, because I think this is something that a lot of authors don't ever really get to look into. And some of them who are, in a way, I look at people who try to self-publish a book and it tanks. It's kind of like a gift you get, right? Because you put it out and you realize, oh, wow, no one is buying this book. And then you go, well, I need to find people who can tell me how they can buy this book. Why aren't they buying it? And then a lot of times you find out, too, is that a lot of times they've scrimped on the graphic art. It's not genre specific, it's not genre appropriate. And with the whole phrase, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. Well, no, people absolutely do judge a book by its cover. And it's a very important thing. I mean, get people who are, if you are a poet, if you're an author, and this is a message to people listening, if you're a poet, if you're an author, you put a lot of hours and work into your craft. Find someone who puts a lot of hours and work into their craft when you're looking at design and you're looking at the cover and the marketing. It's just worth it. Your work deserves better than just, you know, tossing something out there.
Yeah, I think that's a tremendous point. And you know, it's interesting. I'm sure you've had this experience. You'll see a book, and just the moment you look at it, you know, okay, this was somebody's cousin in their basement.
Yep, I couldn't say it better.
Do this for $50. Uh-huh. And you're immediately suspicious of what's inside. You can't help it.
I agree.
And it could be a great book too. I mean, that's the other. But then again, you look at the cover and you say, "Well, it could be, but probably not." If that's the level of detail that went into the cover, you know, and it's unfortunate because it could be a great book in there, but you'd never know. Well, Sean, I have to commend you on that. I think you know, really looking forward to seeing what your press does in the future. Cliff's, like I said, has spoken so well about you, and it's been awesome to hear about everything that you have going on. I guess for me to finish, and Cliff, I'll let you, you know, say something here at the end, but if there's something that you wish that you could impart to the poets and the writers and even the musicians who listen to this podcast, if there's a message or a thought, what would you share with them?
You know, I went through a process where I didn't write anything for 10 years. And part of it was because of my work and I was burned out. I didn't write anything that I wanted to write. And part of it was this constant anxiety over, will anybody read this? Can I get it published anywhere? And finally, one day I decide I'm going to write exactly what I want, the way I want. And if there's readers for it, great. And if not, I'm going to enjoy the process and what I'm doing. That can sound as cliche as you like, but that really turned me around, and it's led to all these other things that I'm doing now.
Both Cliff and myself want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We want to say thank you to Sean Crawford for a great interview. You can find Sean at CalopyCrashes.com or TheCalopyGroup.com.
You can find Cliff Brooks at CliffBrooks.com, also SouthernCollectiveExperience.com. You can find me at MichaelAmade.com or WorldPoetryOpenMic.net. The music for this episode was provided by the fantastic Justin Johnson. You can find him at JustinJohnsonLive.com. Until next time, remember to be courageous, do the hard work, conquer your obstacles creatively, learn to trust your heart, for it's easy to lose your path in this business of music and poetry.